Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
How are you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing pretty well, Justin. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. Any announcements before we start?
Just that CrimeCon is coming up. The thing we love about CrimeCon is that so many listeners show up to talk true crime with us, hang out with us. If you have any doubts about whether to go or not, keep in mind our code, Gen Y, will save you 10%. We'd love to see you out there. We do spend time with people out there, hang out with you. So if you go, we're around. Please come out, say hello. We'd love to meet you.
Check out our social media pages. We're doing a meetup in St. Paul, Minnesota. We're also doing the Potter and Love, which is put on by Jeremy from Podcasts We Listen To. Jeremy's actually starting a new podcast called Educating Jeremy, where he watches movies that he's never seen before, I guess, which is weird. So if you haven't seen the movie Scarface, Jeremy, you need to watch that. That's an episode request.
Not Belly?
No, Scarface.
Okay.
It's classic. So what are we talking about tonight?
Tonight is the somewhat controversial case.
What? Somewhat.
Of Charlie Tan. The community of Pittsford, New York. It's a really nice area. And if you've seen their house, it's pretty nice. It's way nicer than my house. February 9th, 2015, Ching Tan, or Jean Tan, which is Charlie's mother, called 911 saying that her husband had been shot. Jim Tan, or Leong Tan, had been shot multiple times with a shotgun, and all signs seemed to point to his son Charlie as being the shooter. Did Charlie kill his father in cold blood, or was this a result of years of abuse by Jim Tan against his family?
Well, who was Charlie?
Charlie Tan was 19 years old at the time. He was a sophomore at
Cornell, Ivy League, good school.
Yeah, and apparently a really good student, known to be very outgoing, known as the sweetest boy. I mean, he was really, really popular. People loved him. And one of the things that he really got across to people was he wanted to have a positive impact on other people.
He wanted to help. There was like a little movie made about him called Random Acts of Kindness, where he would hand out flowers or money to people. Yeah.
Yeah. So this isn't just the typical, he was a great kid. No, I mean, there were so many people that genuinely believed and witnessed things about him that all back this up. He was attending the university for agriculture and life sciences, and he played sprint football, which, for anyone that doesn't know, and I had to look it up because I had never heard of it, it's basically collegiate football, but there's a weight limit of 178 pounds at the maximum. And so it's supposed to be a faster, more agile game.
Now, Charlie's father, Jim, owned his own tech business.
Yeah, he worked for Eastman Kodak for about 20 years. And then he started a company, Dynamax Imaging, and they created image sensors. He was the president and CEO of that company.
Very well to do. The world is in their palms, right?
Jim, also known as Leong, his wife was Ching Tan, or Jean, as she was known. They had two sons, Jeffrey, and then a younger son, Charlie, which this episode is largely about. And I'll have to say early on here, before we really get into the details, that there isn't much known about Jim. He's kind of a mystery. As we go through the case, we'll kind of explain why that is. And we'll also, I mean, there's no way to avoid it. There's kind of like a large contrast between Jim and his son, Charlie. This case really begins in 2003 when a domestic abuse call comes into the police department from the Tan home. Between 2003 and 2015, there were a total of 18 calls, and they're all very similar. Typically, what happens is Jean is trying to tell the police that her husband is attacking her, and Jim is saying, no, there's nothing to worry about here. And every time the police would come out, he would tell them, you know, she's just being hysterical. There's nothing bad going on here.
It's a well-to-do neighborhood. Who knows what the police response is, because it keeps happening. And if Jim is strangling and choking or hitting his wife, well, it's not being addressed.
It's on January 28th, 2015, when Jean makes a final call to 911 that has to do with domestic abuse. And she's saying that her husband attacked her, he was choking her, and that he wanted to kill her. While she was on the phone, the buttons were being pushed because, as best they can tell, Jim is trying to grab the phone away from his wife. Now, when the officers respond, they see that she has redness all around her neck. In their opinion, it looks like she has been attacked, and they ask her if she wants to press any charges. You know, they're trying to figure out what she wants from this call, because while they can act beyond her, that's from my understanding, is they can actually just say, Jim, you're coming with us, and they can bring him in. But they're really wanting to know what she wants to do. And I don't know how you feel about that, Justin, because people who are suffering abuse and reach out for help, it's not a simple matter of I called for help and now I'm going to report it and then you can haul my husband away. This is a relationship. It's a marriage. And so it's much more complex than you hurt me, now I'm reporting you, and now I'm going to press charges, right?
Yeah, and the police know this because they know domestic violence calls are some of the worst that they can go on because their lives are put in danger also. They've had calls where they show up and the husband's been just torturing the wife, but when they try to take the husband away, it's the wife who's, you know, suffers from the battered woman syndrome or Stockholm syndrome, whatever it is, who will be the biggest protester now. And it's just complex. It's not an easy situation. So they're asking her, do you want us to arrest your husband? Now, he grabbed the phone and said, everything's fine, but you know, they still are going to show up. I don't know if it's a slight language barrier or if she's now scared or what it is, but they do not arrest him that night.
Yeah, she declines to have him arrested. And she does ask the officer, though, about getting an order of protection. So to me, if she is afraid of her husband, she is doing the best she can to reach out for help. And so the officer gives her that information. This is something we don't know whether she followed through with it or not, but we know that she got the information and she knew what to do to actually put in for an order of protection from her husband. That night, Jim did leave the house. And maybe that was a compromise at the time, but that's the way it went down. This is key because this happened late January, and January 9th, there's another call to 911, only this time, it's not a call regarding domestic abuse necessarily, is it?
No, it's Gene saying, there was an argument. I heard a shot. The 911 operator saying, well, what happened? And she says, is there somebody hurt? Do we need to send an ambulance? And Gene says, no, he's already dead.
This is Monday, February 9th, 2015, about 6:10 p.m. And it's the Monroe County Sheriff's deputies who are responding.
During this phone call, she says, he was trying to protect me. And the 911 operator says, your son was trying to protect you? And Gene says, yes.
So it sounds pretty clear at this point, right? Her son shot her husband.
What else do we have to go on besides her own words? When Detective Peglow, who's responding to the 911 call at the home, shows up, he sees that Charlie and his mom are standing outside and he enters the home. The first thing he notices is the smell of decomposition in the air.
Where do they find Jim?
He's laying under the desk. It appears that he was sitting behind his desk doing work and he's been shot 3 times in the face and chest. He notices that the blood is all dried. So not a fresh kill. And there's 3 empty shotgun shells laying around in the room.
This shotgun, which was a Remington shotgun, was found in the garage.
Exactly where Charlie said it was. Because they asked him, where's your father? He said, upstairs. And they said, where's the shotgun? And he said, in the garage. So he's giving them information about the crime scene.
Charlie is telling the deputies where to find the weapon that was used to kill his father.
And where his father is.
Again, Charlie seems to have all the information.
And then they ask, well, what happened? And what does Charlie say?
And he says, he was going to kill my mom. I had to do it.
So there, that's an admission, right?
It sounds like it.
Yeah. There it is.
This is a short case, Justin.
I mean, what else do you need? Like, this is open and shut, right?
So why did we cover this one?
Well, because we always grab the most screwed up cases that we can find in our legal system. So
yeah, well, this is definitely an interesting case. So while it looks cut and dried right now, just hang in there.
They also find a card for domestic court at the house that shows that Gene was supposed to appear for a domestic abuse complaint against her husband. So they take Charlie and his mom to the station and Charlie lawyers up. So they're not getting any more information out of him. Also, during this questioning process that's happened so far, they never read him his Miranda rights. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't use these things against him, but it's a little bit of a technicality. You got a little bit of a wiggle room there.
On February 10th, Charlie was arraigned for the second-degree murder of his father, and then a few days later was indicted, and he was held without bail. They're not going to let him get away, and there's a good reason for this.
Well, he's a Canadian citizen, and his whole family had immigrated to Canada, so they were all Canadian citizens that had moved to America.
They definitely felt like he was a flight risk.
Oh, yeah, because they found a few other things at the home when they did a walkthrough. They found a list of defense attorneys' numbers and passport photos of him and his mother that were just taken for like a passport renewal. It doesn't look good.
That March, Charlie pled not guilty and was released on $50,000 bond.
Now, he had a friend named Anna who started a whole legal fund for him. And she raised $50,000 in this fund because he had a lot of supporters, the coach of his team, all of his friends, his entire frat brotherhood at the college. People came out of the woodwork to support him.
Yeah, his defense attorney said that he had tremendous support, and that's just putting it lightly. This guy was loved. So you can see why they were able to raise the money to get him out and to help fund his defense.
We need to take a break to get a word from our sponsors. ZipRecruiter. Hiring. Every business needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than posting your job online and just praying for the right person to see it. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply for your job. The other way around, right? These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post jobs to ZipRecruiter get qualified candidates through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applicants you receive, so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how to find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. Right now, listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Y. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WHY. ZipRecruiter.com/Y. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. We're also brought to you by Madison Reed. Madison Reed is revolutionizing the way women color their hair. For decades, women have had two options, outdated at-home hair color or the time and expense of a salon. And salons are expensive. Amy created Madison Reed because she believes women deserve better than the status quo. They're reinventing the way women color their hair by offering salon-quality hair color, the convenience and affordability of at-home hair color, an ammonia-free formula with ingredients you can feel good about. You'll look like you just stepped out of the salon, but in reality, you were just at home with me time. Experience beautiful, multidimensional hair color. It's made in Italy, delivered right to your door on your schedule for under $25. Join the hundreds of thousands of women who have tried and loved Madison Reed. Find your perfect shade at madison-reed.com. Madison Reed would like to honor Gen Y listeners with 10% off plus free shipping on your first color kit using the code Y. That code again is W-H-Y. Thank you. Now back to the show.
We've already laid out a lot of points here and evidence, but we need to back up even more now. Where did he get the shotgun? How did this all go down? Because the prosecution has a lot more ammo against him.
So Charlie, he was a member of a fraternity at Cornell. He was a big brother to another student who was going to join the fraternity. And so as part of that, he was overseeing his induction into this fraternity. This is the guy. His name is Whitney Knickerbocker, who was a freshman at Cornell. And he was the one who was asked by Charlie to buy him a shotgun. Charlie was going to give him the money for it. He was going to pay him cash. But this came about because Charlie tried to buy the shotgun himself. And as part of that, you have to fill out a form. Charlie filled it out exactly the way he was supposed to. And because of that, Walmart said, you're a Canadian citizen. We can't just give you the shotgun right now. You have to wait a few days.
Yeah. There's a delay.
And well, that didn't work for Charlie. And so he went to Whitney and said, hey, I'd like to buy a shotgun. And because I'm a Canadian citizen, I can't just go get one. But would you be able to help me with this? And so Whitney did. They go to Walmart and Whitney starts filling out the form, only there's an issue. His identification has a different address.
He didn't get a new driver's license, apparently, because of college and all that.
Yeah, so Charlie didn't give up. He said, hey, I'll drive you over to the DMV and we'll get your address updated and everything. And then we can go back to Walmart and we can buy the shotgun. And so that's what they did.
That's what you call a straw man purchase for anybody that doesn't know the term. That's when you're buying a weapon, not for yourself, but for somebody else. So you're hiding the destination of said gun.
And it just goes to show that despite a law that would prevent Charlie from getting the weapon immediately, well, that didn't stop him.
Now Charlie has a shotgun. Charlie tells his coach on Thursday that he will not be at weightlifting on Friday.
And when he says this, he's crying.
And so his coach is worried because that's what coaches do. They're there for their students. They're there for their team. And he says, well, what's going on? And Charlie says, I'm just having to deal with some family problems. So Charlie leaves Cornell and drives the 100 miles back home. And he's hanging out with a friend. He's not behaving rationally. So his friend's mother sees Charlie and knows that he's taking off. And I think they know he has a shotgun. So she calls 911 to do a welfare check on Charlie at his parents' home Thursday night.
Now, the welfare check was actually called in by Jacob Grossman. And he knew Charlie since the sixth grade. And he was worried about him. And he was in a vehicle with his mother. They actually parked down the street from Charlie's house. I think he didn't want to be seen. You know, it's that whole situation of I'm worried about you, man, but I don't want to be outside. I don't want him to know that I'm the one who called the cops on him.
Yeah. But he's still wanting to see what happens when the cops knock on the door and see what state of mind Charlie's in. So they're watching from afar. So September 14th, 2015, Charlie's murder trial begins. And because of the situation, this well-to-do family, father's murdered, the media and everything is just a circus, you know, following this case.
And what do we know about the jury? The jury was made up of mostly women.
That's correct.
And they had, I believe they had 11 women and 4 or 5 men because they had some alternates that were ready to step in if they needed them.
Yeah.
And all of them heard all of the testimony and stuff. They had to, in case they had to move in and replace other jurors, right?
Yeah, I had 2 alternate jurors when I served, and they just sit in the back of the jury box or off to the side. So if any juror falls sick or gets hit by a bus, whatever the problem may be, they can step in.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
And then we have the prosecution and we have the defense. And what do we know about these people?
The prosecution is DA Bill Gargan. And he's been practicing for a very long time. He knows his stuff. He thinks this is an open and shut case. He also makes a comment saying, oh yeah, this is your typical cry domestic abuse and then kill your husband cliche, which that kind of turns me off when he says that. I must say that I wasn't a fan of some of his comments.
Yeah, because domestic abuse, domestic violence is a very serious thing. And I'm not saying that I believe that he's taking it lightly, but I think in order to push his case forward, I think it ends up sounding that way. And I don't think that's a good thing. And Charlie's attorney is James Nobles. Early on in this defense that he's building for Charlie, he's very much putting forth this visual for the jurors that this is a very abusive household and that Jim Tan was the reason for it.
Yeah, he cites all the calls to 911 that sort of went unanswered in, you know, a sense that Jim was never arrested for assault or domestic abuse. He pretty much does a character assassination on Jim as the domestic abusing father. And he does a full character reference for Charlie as this golden child.
And there's your contrast. Jim is this wealthy, smart guy, but he's very abusive. And both of his sons and his wife suffered for it. And then Charlie is this really stand-up guy who has a great reputation and many, many people love him. There were people supporting him probably blindly because they just knew him. And they said, this is not a killer. And that's what they were working with.
So the prosecution is going through, hey, this is what happened the night of. We have these statements. His mom is saying there was an argument. Somebody was shot. We have the murder weapon on scene. We have Charlie's friend on video buying it from Walmart. We know the weapon's there. There weren't any fingerprints found on the shotgun. Charlie's fingerprints were found on the shotgun shell, but not on the shotgun itself. The prosecution is just rolling with this, saying, hey, we have motive. We have this situation. It was not in the heat of the moment because we have a 3 or 4 day old body, because the emails that Jim was sending, because he runs a company, they ceased on Thursday night at around 8:30 in the PM. So he wasn't active on his computer any longer after Thursday night. So we're looking at this and we're assuming that Charlie drove home in a not so great state of mind, had a welfare check done on him, and then confronted his father, blew him away, and they don't call until Monday to report the shooting. So you don't have the heat of the moment. Also, his father's body's found behind his computer desk. So it wasn't like it was him on top of his mother beating her or something in an altercation. Also, the whole buying of the shotgun, that purchase, very premeditated, getting his friend to buy it. His friend can't buy it. He's got to take him to the DMV. Premeditation, murder weapon. The mother saying he was trying to protect me on the phone, and then Charlie's own statement saying, I had to do it. Right?
Right. And then they also had testimony from Jacob Grossman, who we mentioned earlier. He talked about how he got a call from Charlie, and this was on February 5th, very early that morning. Charlie had said, you know, I need to talk with you, and they made arrangements to meet. But what they discussed was Charlie asked him, according to Jacob's testimony, how much money he had, because he said he needed to flee the country. So there you have the, you know, you have more evidence that there was something really going on with Charlie here. Not only, as Justin said, he had, I had to do it, but then he was also telling a friend, I'm going to leave the country.
And he also sent the email to his fraternity brothers saying, you're going to hear some things in the media about me that are not true. It's showtime.
Yeah, I'm going to read this email because I think it's interesting. When you go through this case, it seems cut and dried. And then Charlie's own words make it seem even more cut and dried. He wrote, my brothers, in the coming days, you will start to hear things in the news and possibly get a couple visits from the authorities. Don't listen to anything you hear. A few already know my true story, and in due time, you will also. I love you all so much, and you have given me the family I never had. I can only hope I have left a positive impression on all of your lives as well. And I'll skip ahead here, but he ends it saying, the best days are ahead of all of us, and I promise I will be back in the future. In the meantime, I hope you will visit. And he closes it out by saying, as always, blank the haters. Love, Charlie Tan.
Blank, fill in the word, whatever you want to put in there. Also, we have Whitney, the purchaser of the shotgun, who testifies kind of against Charlie, you know, talking about the whole purchase of this weapon and how Charlie told him it was for hunting, which I wouldn't have pegged him as a hunter, but whatever.
Well, and this is also probably to show that he's not really privy to why Charlie wanted that shotgun. You know, this is a very common, popular shotgun. It's a Remington 870, and I don't think there's a bigger shotgun than that. Is there, in terms of popularity?
No, no, it's your standard 12-gauge pump.
So during the trial, the prosecution seems to be doing a good job, right? They have a lot on their side. They have all the evidence they need to show that Charlie is the likely killer, but we didn't go over what they didn't have.
Well, they don't have a solid investigation. We don't have fingerprints on the murder weapon. We don't have his mother testifying for or against him.
They don't really have proof of who used the shotgun. They have proof of who purchased the shotgun. They know that Charlie got the shotgun, right? But they don't have proof that he actually shot his father.
The prosecution is going after him with this preconceived notion that the defense is going to use self-defense or protecting his mother as their explanation and trying to get on the jury's good side of this was a justified killing.
Yeah, it's almost like there was no choice here, but they're careful with how they're setting this up. The most the prosecution can say is they have a fingerprint of Charlie's on one of the shells. I don't know what it is about this case, but they're trying to convince the jury that Charlie is this great kid, that he wouldn't maliciously harm somebody unless he had to. And that's the only time he would use violence, if he actually had to stand up for somebody. And yet that's not how this trial winds up. I mean, it seems really clear throughout the trial that you have the prosecution saying you have this basic confession from him. You have the mother saying this on 911. You have him giving us all these details, and then add in the fact that his father was murdered, but he probably was in that office for a good 3-4 days before the call ever came in that he was dead. And the defense is saying, look, this was an abusive household. And yet that's not how it ends up. They don't come out and finish with Charlie was protecting his family. He was protecting his mother. It looks like it's going to go that way. And they point out all the problems with the investigation. They just didn't do a thorough investigation. They should have had a lot more evidence to bring in. And I think it's because as soon as someone gives what's perceived to be a confession, there's this false sense of, we gotcha. And that may work on a TV show, but when it goes to a court of law, it's not that easy. How do they finish, Justin? What does the defense do near the end of trial?
Well, they have a game plan. You know, just imagine two football teams going at it, and one is going to pass the ball whereas the other team is expecting them to kick. And so their plays are not matching up, and the defense's play is a little bit different. They go through the whole trial never once saying Charlie did this to defend his mother or defend himself, ever. But in their closing arguments, where it's really hard to object and get these statements shot down, what do? They throw a Hail Mary pass, right? They go for broke.
It might be that, or it may be that they kept something secret. You know, they had like a secret play in their back pocket, kind of like where you fake a pass, but you're actually passing it off, or maybe you're tossing it to another player to run with. And yeah, Justin, give him the play.
So they go to his confession of, I had to do it. I had to protect my mother. And they say, this isn't a confession. How do we know he's not saying, I had to get the shotgun, as opposed to, I had to shoot my father? And then the defense goes over, picks up the shotgun, and says, this is how his mother killed Jim. So they put the whole guilt and the whole action on his mom. And they say, you don't know who the trigger person was. So this is not beyond a reasonable doubt.
And isn't that the most important thing when it comes to defense, is being able to show that there's a reasonable doubt?
Exactly. And I guess this is, in a weird way, the perfect defense is, there was two people there. You don't know. You cannot say which one pulled the trigger. So therefore, you cannot find him guilty.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, it's like Michael Peterson. His wife's dead. It's either him or the owl. You can't prove it either way. You know, that's their whole sort of defense. And I get it. But I think that it's obvious Charlie did it.
And that's going to upset some of you who say, look, it's obvious Charlie shot his dad. Why are we just going to accept this reasonable doubt defense? Because we already know who did it. Again, this is a court of law. And if there is reasonable doubt, as there is in this case now, because of how it was presented in court, I say they've got it. This is a great defense, and credit to Jim Nobles for coming up with it. But how does the jury take it, though, Justin?
Well, they deliberate for 5 days, or what's, I think they say 80 hours or some outrageous number. And at the end of 5 days, we have 8 jurors saying guilty and 4 saying not guilty, which, that's a deadlock. And there's a little bit of discrepancy here, but they say at the end of the 5 days, the jury goes to the judge and says, we're deadlocked. We're not getting any further. And so the judge will declare a hung jury and a mistrial. Now, if you see some interviews with the jurors, they will say, no, we were still deliberating. We were wanting to keep going. Where I'm like, I don't know if a judge would declare mistrial if the jurors were saying, no, we're fine, leave us alone, we're still talking it out. So I kind of side more with them going to the judge and saying, no, we're deadlocked and we're not getting any further because we got 4 not guilties.
I think it's the passion of the jurors. They don't want to let it go because they really believe Charlie did it, and they're trying to hold him accountable. Right? They don't have a dog in the race. Charlie's not a friend. All they know is how the case was presented. And for them, it's pretty clear that Charlie was the killer. And so with it being deadlocked, it's as though they feel like the case was ripped and torn from their hands. Right?
Yeah. They think, well, Charlie's mother is this smaller, slender woman. She couldn't have held a 12-gauge shotgun, pumped it, you know, 2 times and shooting it into Jim Tan. They just don't buy it. So they think he's guilty.
But again, this is about what you can prove.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the problem here.
There's a lot of controversy with this judge, Judge Pompeiano. Some people are claiming that he declared a mistrial just to end it, just to get it over with, because he had an election coming up, which he won, by the way.
Well, yeah, on the election, he could have just kept the jurors deliberating during the election if he wanted to. I don't think that would have harmed him too much, because that's a neutral stance. So that's why I do believe that the jurors came and said, we're deadlocked, and he declared a mistrial. But when they reconvene to talk about the retrial, the defense always files a motion to dismiss. That's just standard operating procedure. If your defense attorney doesn't file that motion, you should probably get a new defense attorney. So they're doing the pre-hearing for the retrial. Everybody shows up and they're going through their normal process. And the judge starts talking about the motion to dismiss. And he starts talking about the lack of evidence. He starts talking about how the prosecution didn't prove anything. And that's why the last trial was a mistrial. And this isn't sounding good to the prosecution, what he's saying. So the prosecutor, he starts talking and cutting the judge off, right?
Yeah, well, Gargan truly believes that Charlie is the killer. And I get that. He doesn't want to let this go, and he doesn't like the language that the judge is using. So in his idea, he's being professional. That's what he says. But the judge doesn't like this. This is the judge's courtroom. He can make the decision.
Yeah, the prosecutor says, can I speak? The judge says no. And then he continues speaking, and the judge tells the bailiff to go over and says, I will have you handcuffed. And, you know, I always hear people say, I've never seen or seen this happen in court before. I don't think I've ever heard of a judge threatening a prosecutor DA with arrest in the court ever myself. So that's the one time I will say, yeah, I've never seen that happen before. So the judge completes his thought and dismisses all charges against Charlie Tan, which is interesting because normally I always felt that at the end of a mistrial or something to that effect, it was up to the prosecutor on whether or not they wanted to file new charges. I actually learned something on this case that the judge can say, nope, there's not going to be a retrial. And that should have just been common knowledge for me, but I guess I've never seen it happen before, right?
The judge said, regarding his decision, he said that Charlie's statement to police that I had to do it was equivocal at best and unsupported by any evidence in the case at worst. His decision lines up with the defense's case. With the defense's argument, there just wasn't enough evidence. If you look at the brilliant play by Jim Nobles in this, it really makes you take another look at the case. At least it did me. And then you think, yeah, you know, they didn't really have it. They didn't have proof that Charlie did this. And there's some factors here to keep in mind. I mean, since the murder likely happened days before the call came in reporting the death, then there was no way to test them for gunshot residue. So there's a lot of evidence that police probably couldn't have gotten anyway. It's just when you have to look at it and say you can't prove who did it, can you really retry him? There was a court in early 2017, an appeals court ruled that Charlie would not have a new trial, and the prosecutors ran out of appeal avenues. So this appeals court, they sort of go against the judge in that they indicate that there was enough evidence to have another trial against Charlie, but that they weren't going to go against the judge's ruling.
They weren't going to defy the system.
Yeah, I think it really depends on how you look at our justice system, and that will determine how you feel about this case, because on one hand, you have all these people that are so happy that Charlie was freed. And then you have these other people who say, well, no, he got the shotgun. He went home. And if you look at the coroner's report and you look at how the prosecution laid out that Charlie may have even fled the country from February 6th through the 9th, that he had to have killed his father and then tried to split, you won't like this decision. But for anybody who believes that we need to have a system that relies on reasonable doubt as the deciding factor, then this is a perfect example of a defense that knew exactly how to play this case despite the surprise. I mean, I'm not an attorney, but, you know, I was really, really surprised by the way they played that in their closing arguments.
I don't think it would have worked in a retrial either, because everybody knows their tactic, their strategy now. So they know that they're going to go with, you can't prove who the trigger person was.
Well, for the sake of argument, what would they have countered it with, do you think? Let's say they do know it's coming. and they have a retrial, what can they bring to kind of fight the defense that was put up by Jim Nobles there at the end?
Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
I don't know if they could bring anything more than they already did because of they were hanging it on the confession. They were hanging it on the phone call. They were hanging it on the delay in reporting of the crime. And so I think of other cases where we normally see the opposite happen, right? We normally see the judge more or less on the prosecution side, making exculpatory evidence, you know, not admissible, just things like that. And not allowing appeals from the accused. Normally, that's what we see, at least in our research. I won't say that that's the norm. I don't know. But at least in our research, the cases that we look at, it's normally the judge is on the prosecution side, not the defense's.
Yeah, if you had to say one way or the other, it seems like they side more with the prosecution. I would say that even if you got him a retrial, I don't think the prosecution has an answer for that. I don't think that they were actually keeping this as a secret and that they were going to play it at the end like that. I'm almost wondering if Jim Nobles came up with this along the way because they really wanted to go ahead early on with, hey, this was an abusive household and this is a great guy. And if his father was murdered in the home, it's because there was all this abuse happening. So they're putting up a defense, but not really building it up as Charlie being the killer. But I wonder if along the way they decided, wait a minute, they don't actually have proof that he pulled the trigger. So then they're like, why don't we just do that? Now there's reasonable doubt. I wonder if that was just not so much a strategy, but a revelation.
Mm-hmm. I kind of agree with you on that one.
It's totally possible. I mean, it could have gone either way, but I think it's also really possible that this was just something that just hit them along the way and said, wait a minute, I can't think of anything that the prosecution could do differently. Because they're kind of stuck with the investigation, with the way it went, and then they're still pinning all their hopes on a supposed confession and a supposed statement that's pretty damning by the mother. But when you look at it as she says he did it, but that's just what she said. And she also said she just heard a noise and an argument. So she wasn't in the room, supposedly. And then you have Charlie's statement being looked at as, well, he didn't say I murdered my father. I shot my father. He may have just been talking about getting the shotgun. And that's what he meant when he said, I had to protect my mother. I had to do it. You know,
I think that this went down poorly for Charlie and his mom in the fact that if Charlie would have waited for his dad to get aggressive, to do something, and then shot him in the heat of the moment and not behind a desk, I think he would have had a better, I guess, argument or justification, but he's got a lot of support either way. But for somebody like me who's looking at this, I'm like, dude, you probably shot your dad and then you didn't report the crime for over, you know, 3-4 days. I'm thinking there's premeditation here. I'm thinking that you did this. Now, if his dad truly is this abusive monster, which I think there's enough evidence to prove that too. I think of what was our one case that we covered, Dixie Shanahan, where the wife was abused by the husband. So she waited for him to go to sleep and then she put a gun to him and killed him while he slept. Or I think of our favorite person, Robert Durst, who allegedly murdered his next door neighbor in self-defense, allegedly, and chopped his body up with a bow saw, put his body parts in garbage bags, and then tossed them into the ocean. And these people are getting off. When I look at Charlie's case, I don't see the heat of the moment, that element to it, but that's not the context here, really. That's a whole other argument. That's a whole other debate on whether or not his father was abusive and deserved to die or deserved justice, whatever it may be, and they were trying to remove themselves out of this bad situation. So it got me thinking, like, well, what is justice here? So just as a thought experiment, I'm not advocating that we let murderers walk free. What if Charlie was found guilty? What are we accomplishing by putting him in jail for the rest of his life? Besides, well, he's not going to harm anybody else, but I don't think he's going to harm anyone else if it's only about killing an abusive father. I don't know. It's just a thought experiment. I think I might have been on the guilty side on that jury myself. But if you find him guilty, what are we accomplishing? What is society gaining from this? After Charlie was exonerated, or charges were dismissed, really, he tried to go back to Cornell, but the administration said, you have violated our code of conduct, so there will be punishment, disciplinary actions. So Charlie did not reapply or did not return to Cornell. Charlie's brother and his mom are now running the company that their late father owned and was running. So I'm not sure if you have a motive here of Charlie planned this with his mother for financial gain, which appears to be sort of the prosecution's narrative is, well, she called, that phone call was fake. I guess it would be the long game call of her calling this 911 for years to end up doing this later. But I think the duration of the calls and the record keeping shows that there was a problem there. But I don't know. I don't know what we're gaining if Charlie did go away for life.
Well, some would argue that such an individual has to pay for their crime. I mean, this was obviously a premeditated murder.
Well, I agree.
The shotgun being purchased the way it was, there's just so much here to show that without proof that he did it, that's where there are going to be enough people that say that's reasonable doubt. We don't know if it was his mother that did it or whether he did it. We do know he helped. And another problem with this case, and something that Charlie's defense attorneys bring up, is that Whitney Knickerbocker purchased the shotgun, and when he filled out the form as part of the purchase, he lied on it. You have to state on there whether you're buying it for yourself or for someone else.
Because you're not allowed to buy it for somebody else. That's it. That's the whole thing. And he lied. But was Whitney charged with a federal gun crime?
Not that I could find. As far as I know, and this is what the defense attorneys allege, is that maybe he was very, very helpful to the prosecution because they said, you know, if you show up at trial for us, we're not going to pursue this. You know, you don't have to worry about a charge coming down against you for this illegal purchase.
Oh, yet another illegal purchase of a gun that goes to an alleged murderer that goes unaccounted for. All right, got it. That's kind of what people have a problem with, is this lack of accountability when it comes to enforcing gun laws that are already on the books.
Yeah, that's true. But on the other hand, you wonder if without that leverage, and I'm going to call it leverage because it seems a lot like leverage to me, would Whitney have testified against his big brother, you know, as he was known in the fraternity? I think that's very questionable whether he would have done that or not.
And I guess they are coming back at Charlie with federal gun charges, but I'm looking at this and thinking, he asked this guy to buy him a gun and Whitney bought him the gun. I mean, I guess I'm looking at this like, okay, prove that Charlie was the one in the wrong here, because you kind of have a weak case, because it's Whitney that bought him the gun because he asked. Whitney didn't have to do it.
He's the one who lied on the form. He was purchasing the gun.
So good luck with that. I hope that they do hold somebody accountable for it, but who knows what will happen. If they do get a guilty verdict for that, then hooray. And I guess we have justice now.
Since Jim Tan was shot 3 times with a shotgun, and we don't know exactly who fired the shotgun, I mean, for all they know, every member of his family took a shot at him. Jim Tan's company, Dynamax Imaging, was later sued. This was in 2015, but it was sued after his death by Pangea. And what they said was that Jim Tan had taken out loans from them and that he never paid them back. And so the lawsuit was for $1 million. This complaint that was filed by Pangea said that Jim Tan became familiar with them through business contacts and got these business loans so that he could take care of some costs and expenses. The loans totaled $955,000.
So cases like this is why we love true crime, right? This is the sort of anomaly in our justice system. A case like this has people talking forever. I mean, this is what I stopped reading and getting into true crime for the murder and for the mayhem. I'm more or less into it for weird cases like this.
Yeah, I think, again, you have people who will look at this case and they'll say, you're letting a killer go free. And other people will look at it and say, well, we have our justice system in place and this is the way it went. And so that is the right decision, right? I mean, the judge came out and said, look, the jury's deadlocked. They can't all agree on this. Really, I think there's no way you can say that those 4 jurors are wrong. You might say that the 8 have their case. You know, you can see how they got to their decision, but then the 4, they see the reasonable doubt and you can't tell them that they're wrong. I mean, we have so many people in prison and you're telling me that we just have to push this guy in there too? There's reasonable doubt here. So I really find this case interesting because Justin and I both believe that he murdered his dad. But we also know that the prosecution doesn't quite have enough. Not really. They have a lot of suggestive evidence, but they just don't have the proof. It's a lot like the Scott Peterson case. You know, he looks guilty. It totally looks like he murdered his wife. But when you get down to it and you say, all right, now prove it. You go, well, it looks like he did. And you can believe he did. But proving it, that's difficult. If you're going to be honest and look back at these cases, there are a number of cases out there that you know the answer sort of maybe, but proving it, you're going to have to let Charlie go because you can't prove that he pulled the trigger, that he killed his father.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next $1 billion company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere. With venture capital pouring in
from Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift.
She is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.